RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our regular Thursday Money Talks, and it's my pleasure to welcome a new contributor to our Money Talks for this week, and I'm sure for weeks ahead as well. He is Louis Boulanger, a retired actuary and the founder and director of Louis Boulanger Now Limited, LB Now. He's a chartered financial analyst and a fellow of the SFA Society of New Zealand, an award he received in 2022 for his services to the industry. Prior to coming to New Zealand in 86, Louis worked for 9 years with a global consulting firm based in Montreal, Canada. In New Zealand, he worked for another global consulting firm, Mercer, for 18 years, including as chief executive of NZ Ops for 5 years. In 2004, Louis took time off to study monetary history, including the role of gold as money. Louis's practice provides independent investment advice to wholesale clients only and bullion services to private and institutional clients of all sizes. Louis, welcome to RCR Money Talks. Thanks for coming on. It's great to meet you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to join you, Paul.
Got to ask you this question. What's it like to hold a bar of gold? I've never done it.
Well, it's about time you do.
Yeah, I know where to go now.
There's bars of all sizes and weights. But I'll tell you what, holding what's called the wholesale bar or the London bullion market bar of 400 ounces, which is now worth $1 million, wow. and going still up is a fabulous feeling.
Yeah.
But even holding a 1 ounce gold coin, I mean, do it. You know, it's a good feeling.
There's something about it, right? I mean, I know everyone knows that, but there is something about that metal which is unlike any other. What is it, Louis? What is the essence of it?
Well, I can't tell you from a chemical point of view or you know, but it's natural. It's in nature, and mankind or humankind has over time through millennia used it as money. And unfortunately, today it's outside our system and therefore not considered to be money by most practitioners, but it still is money.
Yeah.
And the reason it became money, Paul, is basically because, you know, in the primitive early days when people went to market to barter their goods and wanting to exchange what they had for what they wanted, they needed some kind of medium in the middle of exchange. And what ended up from experience working the best was gold. And why is that? Is because it was the most marketable good. And why is that? Is because it's, you know, people were just as happy getting rid of it in order to get what they wanted, you know, in form of, as a payment, as people receiving it because they knew they could buy later on what they want. So it's evolved not through states or nations or governments deciding gold was money, but, you know, it's how people found out they would get to their ends more efficiently.
Yeah, so everyone agrees on that as a value, but also there's a rarity factor to it as well. Is that part of it?
Well, it is part of why gold can be used as a standard to measure value. And that's what really the gold standard was all about. And the reason why gold was particularly good to serve in that role is because of the high stock to flow ratio. Let me explain what that is. The amount of gold above ground in existence is very high, you know, just over 200,000 tons. It's held in one way or another, but gold never melts or decays. It remains. And that's all essentially in theory available at the right price. But the amount of gold that's added to this above ground supply is after enormous amount of work and exploration and what have you at great cost is about 3,000 tons. Give or take. So the supply of gold increases by about 1.5%, let's say, between 1% and 2% a year. So it's very stable. And that gives gold a property of, excuse the jargon, the lowest declining marginal utility of any good, which makes it stable as a unit or as a good to use to measure value. And that's why gold served as the unit to define currencies which were redeemable in gold and certain weights of gold. We're far from that now, but, you know, that's the history.
I take it there's a big gulf now between the quantity, the weight of gold available, and the value of fiat currency as we understand it now. Have the two totally disconnected?
Well, fiat currencies are completely disconnected from gold, but it doesn't prevent you from measuring their value or their purchasing value in gold. Gold is a currency, gold's money. So you can, for example, I mean, when people say the gold price is now, whatever, $2,500 an ounce, it's not really the gold price, it's really the gold US dollar exchange rate. You know, when you look at the euro, you basically look at its exchange rate with the dollar. Or currencies are not defined in any shape or form. Ask anyone to define what a dollar is. They won't be able to. It's just a currency that's declared to be the legal tender, and you have to use it as money. But, you know, basically, gold also is money, and therefore it can be used to measure the value of your currency or fiat currency. And this is what you can do by looking at what the gold price does, essentially, because it's an exchange rate, you know.
Mm. What got you to New Zealand, Louis? Just curious. Come all this way, bottom of the world. What happened?
Well, I certainly didn't expect back in 85, when I was approached to come here and open an office for Mercer, that I would still be here for almost 40 years later. Yeah. It was like a three-year contract. But we ended up liking the place, and we're still here. The reason I was asked to come here is New Zealand was maybe not in desperate needs of actuaries, but it was in need of actuaries. Or maybe, I don't know how many actuaries there were in New Zealand back then, but, you know, quite a few when I say quite a few relative to the amount of current actuaries that were already here, maybe six, seven came from Canada around that time. And in fact, you'll be interested in this. Roger Douglas was Minister of Finance then, and he was the regulator in effect, as the Minister of Finance was the regulator of actuaries back then. I'm not quite sure whether that's still the case or not. He signed a letter saying, let this guy in, basically.
His signature on...
No point system, no nothing.
Right. Well, they must have wanted you. Can you just remind us what an actuary actually does?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, the profession is basically one that kind of tries to discount future liabilities or current liabilities, looking at the future scenarios possible. So it's, how do I define what it actually does? It looks at like insurance is a concept invented by actuaries. By pooling large numbers, they could pool risk together and afford, by charging the right premium and looking at whether the reserves were appropriate over time, whether the insurance could offer a payment on the risk of dying prematurely or things like that. So those kinds of concepts evolved to what we call here in New Zealand superannuation or pension or retirement system, you know, how to fund that and how to... I spent the bulk of my career as a consulting actuary when I was practicing as an actuary to help firms fund their obligations in terms of employee benefits, and in particular superannuation or pension plans, and just make, you know, with assumptions, you discount the future, assumptions of all kinds, you know, and so garbage in, garbage out. So you try and have as good assumptions as you can, and that's what actuary does. So actuaries work behind the scenes, really. They don't deal with the general public. No individual needs or should need, unless you go through a divorce. You know, some actuaries are involved in helping as right. expert witnesses what is the value of the share of the partner that's interested in capitalizing that now. So that's another application, if you like, of what actuaries can do. But generally, actuaries work for governments, insurance companies, corporates, and so not the general public.
Going to get on to more about gold shortly, but I'm curious because you arrived at an interesting time.
Oh, yes.
Because I remember that time well. I'm old enough to remember it. We went from being what was described as some sort of East European-style command economy to within 3 or 4 years, and it was a Labour government, so it was kind of unexpected, to all these massive, rapid changes in finance, the economy, you know, how things were imported, exported, what was subsidised, what wasn't. It was a huge change, and yes. You kind of landed probably just after that started. What were the impressions you had then and that you remember now?
Well, my very first impression was as I was ending my week's visit here to decide whether I wanted to take the job offer or not, and I had almost virtually concluded that maybe no, I don't want to come to New Zealand. It's really behind, and it's too small. I already had quite a good job in Montreal with large clients, and so I relaxed, and there was no TV in the room to tell you, you know, I was 85, but still there was no TV in the room. I was in the Northern Club back then. And so I turned the radio on, and lo and behold, it was Roger Douglas giving his, reading his budget speech of 85. Yeah. And I happened to, by coincidence, or is it the universe? Telling
both,
me,
probably.
come.
Yeah.
And then the top marginal tax rate was falling immediately, like at midnight, or, you know, not over 10 years or something like that, from 66% to 33%.
And wow, I just that's right.
Couldn't, yeah. I realized during my week here in 85, August, I think it was 85, that things were happening. You know, things were, it was good. You know, New Zealand was finally doing the right thing to get out of its terrible situation. But that to me signaled that it would be fantastic for a consultant or an actuary to be in New Zealand at that time. And I was proven right.
Yeah, he swung it for you right there and then. No TV, even back then we had TVs. I don't know what the hell was going
on. I know, but
there.
I mean, I think the Northern Club back then was not what it is now.
Okay.
I mean, the rooms are better now. I mean, if anyone
do you think they've got the internet
from the Northern
on there,
Club
yeah.
listening to this.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, and you've been here then all this time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know where we're at now. It is a completely different country, though a lot of people say now, oh, maybe those times weren't so bad.
Mm.
What would you say if you heard someone saying that? I mean, is that just sort of rose-tinted spectacles, you know, dreaming of the past? And as we do, we tend to do, don't we, as we get older?
Well, good times come and go, and we are certainly living perilous times, I would say, on many fronts. We can go into that if you like, but monetarily speaking, the world was thrown overnight into floating abstractions, as I like to call them, floating yes. currencies.
Yeah,
where Nixon, it's an increasingly known fact of history, but not well understood and not really widely known. But, you know, the U.S. had an obligation. They had a privilege. De Gaulle, the French general at the time, called it an exorbitant privilege. And it was that they were the only currency in the system after World War II that was exchangeable or redeemable on demand by countries in gold at a stated amount, which, by the way, was $35 an ounce. But that came with an obligation to, in fact, redeem their dollars for gold at that rate, according to the Bretton Woods system, to any country that wished to do so, if they wished to convert their reserves that they had in dollars for gold, because they thought, you know, the U.S. was living beyond its means, especially during the Vietnam War, and debt was going up. This is precisely what France did. Anyway, long story short, it came to a point where the gold reserves of the U.S., which the U.S. had the bulk of the gold reserves in the world, as you can imagine, at the end of the Second World War, they were being depleted quite rapidly, and that was beginning to become not acceptable to the authorities, and correctly so. What they could have done is just redefine the value of the dollar, but they were not prepared to do that. So I think during a Bonanza show on TV, which was interrupted on a Sunday night, de Gaulle announced to not just Americans, but the entire world that the U.S. would temporarily close that, what they euphemistically called the gold window, temporarily. Well, here we are 53 years later, and we're still living the consequences of that. The world has adjusted, you know, and decided to trust the dollar for what it's worth, not knowing exactly what it is worth. And in fact, you know, this so-called oil crisis of the 70s, you know, wasn't really an oil crisis. The Arabs were just continuing to price their oil in gold. And as the gold price, which was floating after the Nixon shock, went up and up and up and up, basically the Arabs were pricing their oil in the same number.
Oh, I see how that
barrel.
Worked. Right.
So it was just the world was, you know, trusting the dollar less and less. And but how did that end was very interesting. You know, in 1980, or was it 81? I can't remember. But Volcker, this tall central bank, one of the last good central bankers in the U.S., it basically said, let interest rates go where the market will clear, which will resume, confidence in the dollar will resume. And interest rates had to go very high in the double digits, basically. And but today it's unimaginable that they would do that, because even at current rates, I mean, the U.S. is now spending over $1 trillion just servicing, just paying interest on that debt.
Yeah.
And that's the second largest item on their list of things to pay for. So, anyway, it's...
Yeah, I remember paying 17% for a mortgage back then,
yeah,
and thinking we got quite a good deal at the time. You reminded me also, you know, the history of gold. I was reading the other day, coming out, one of the mechanisms for coming out of the Depression was, and I forget who, was it FDR was the... the president then, maybe not him, the one before him, but that they said they'd buy up all the gold and exchange it for cash, bought it at $25 an ounce, and then immediately, once they'd done that, revalued it to the 35 that you mentioned, and essentially devalued the currency that people had received for their gold almost overnight.
So that was the first default factoid of the U.S., government on its obligation to redeem what was then redeemable dollars for gold to the it was to the local citizenry.
Yeah,
they passed an executive order requesting citizens to hand in their gold, because that would help, and they claimed the Depression, which had nothing to do with that, but they. They did, and at the gold price was $20.67, I think, an ounce back at that time. And shortly thereafter, they redefined the dollar to be not, you know, 1/20th of an ounce, but 1/35th of an ounce, so $35 an ounce. So basically, you know, everybody got paid for the gold that they redeemed, but nobody benefited from what was the increased value of gold. Now, that was the first default. I call it a default. I don't know. I don't think that they will ever call it a default, but it was a default. But it was domestic. And it took until 1975 before Americans could buy gold again. They were prohibited by law to buy gold. in the U.S., of all places.
It's amazing.
It is. It is absolutely the mind boggles, right? But there you have it. And the second default was obviously Nixon, and that default was towards foreign countries.
You said we're in perilous times, Louis. What do you mean by that?
Well, I keep telling people who want to listen that we have unsound money. And with unsound money, you have unsound situation, unsound relations, unsound exchanges. And there is an increasing realization in the world that something needs to happen to the monetary system. People are losing faith in it, but not you know, the people who are largely responsible with managing money, unfortunately. They're all in the system, and they're doing a great job in doing their best job in the system rather than being concerned about the system. I say unsound money is the problem, the root cause. If think about this, you know, if we had sound money, and that necessarily means that gold would be within that system to keep people in charge, honest in terms of how much they issue new money, or how much debt is added. That debt needs to be repaid in order to maintain confidence in your ability to maintain the purchasing power of the currency, right? I mean, that's you don't need a degree in economics to grasp that, right? I mean, if your debt grows and you never pay it back, and this is what essentially we've been living for, you know, decades now. I'm talking about the U.S., which is what matters. That's what matters because the whole system is U.S. dollar based. And so what happens in the U.S. with respect to debt, by debt I mean the federal government funded debt. We won't go into all the unfunded liabilities and the state debt and the corporate debt, just sticking to the federal debt. And while it's very clear, you can any mathematician looking at the problem would immediately conclude that it can't be settled, it can't be paid back, it's just too large. You would need an enormous economic growth to do that, which is hard to see unless you believe in alien invasions or AI changing everything or whatever, you know. So
why not?
So that's the problem. And that's the problem because what we call money today is debt. You know, what we call money today are reserve banks notes. And a note is a bank note is a debt. And so it's based on debt.
How perilous, we're in perilous times. Why? And how perilous? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk now that there's some kind of imminent something, shock or... You know, that something will give that's on many people's minds. So I guess I was asking you about it being perilous with that in mind.
Well, there is a lot going on with the BRICS Plus groups. What they're trying to do is you know, can put yourself in their shoes. They're tired of being sanctioned for everything that the U.S. disagrees with. So in some cases, you know, what they do is wrong, and you know, some kind of reaction is appropriate, but the sanctions are pretty gratuitously imposed on regimes that or nations, sovereign nations that want to manage their affairs their way. They're sovereign, so they should be able to. And so they're since the 2008 crisis, I always remember this after the 2008 crisis. There was an IMF meeting in Washington, and there, you know, and the G20 meeting, and what, and everybody was there, but there was nothing was really going the way of the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, you know, those people. So that's when they decided to let's start sitting together, and they've been working for 15 years now at developing an infrastructure that bypasses the dollar system, because it is a dollar system. The SWIFT system and everything else goes through all, you know, U.S. banks. And that was fine as long as you know you're honest in your ways of dealing with that responsibility. But I think they've abused and they've weaponized now with all the sanctions. And the catalytic to accelerate things in that direction was when the U.S. confiscated Russian the reserves Russia had in foreign currencies.
$300 billion. Yeah, $300 billion, wasn't it?
That's, you know, so everybody around the world sort of realized, well, you know, they can do it to us too, I guess. Yeah. And so what comes out of all that, I don't know. You know, it's very, not very transparent, all the workings of the BRICS. There is a meeting coming up next month. Every year there's a summit. We'll see if anything transpires. I wouldn't hold my breath on, you know, the U.S. dollar losing its prevalence as a reserve currency at all. I don't think they attempt to replace the dollar as a reserve currency. That would be a waste of time. There's no liquidity around any other currency of theirs or any new currency that they would issue that would enable that. But they can issue a form of settlement currency or payment or, you know, but they want is trade. They want to be able to trade without sanctions in their own currencies or a currency that they can all accept. So that's happening. I mean, perilous times also geopolitically. I mean, I think, you know, what's going on in Ukraine is quite insane. And not just Ukraine, but particularly Ukraine. I mean, why would you want to poke the bear that much, you know?
Who knows? I don't know. Many of us are asking that question, unless there's something we don't know.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's my own personal view, and this might not agree with many listeners, but Russia does not want to play ball with what the West wants Russia to do. But they're a sovereign nation, so they should let it be, right? And in good relations, but they don't want to. That's because the U.S. wants to maintain their hegemony, and they cannot maintain hegemony with a strong Russia. As simple as that.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like they're getting very far in Ukraine, but the U.S. They're the proxy, aren't they?
No, they're not. They're not. They're going backwards.
Yeah, and how could you ever think you could win against? We know the history of Russia generally.
Yes.
You know, they won the Second World War. Actually, I mean, as hard as it is to take, you know.
Absolutely, Paul. And in fact, you know, so few people of the younger generation realize that. You know, if it hadn't been for back then Soviet Union, but Russia. We'd never have won Second World War.
And if I was Putin, I'd be pissed about that because they lost so many more people than anyone all put together almost. So, you know, I think they've earned their place, haven't they?
Yes. Well, I think the original intent or objective, as Putin said when he decided to move into Ukraine to at the invitation of people in the Donbass, was to demilitarize Ukraine and denazify Ukraine.
You
can take that however you like, but, you know, they don't want Nazis in their backyards.
Yeah, they're very – he chose those words. Okay, circling back, as they say, Louis, is gold some kind of insurance, some kind of hedge, some kind of security then in a perilous – time where you don't know what's going to happen to currencies, you don't know what is going to happen next geopolitically in the world, is that at least something that can bring you a bit of peace of mind?
Yes, well, it's an asset that is nobody's liability, unlike every other investment, every financial security, or whether it's money in the bank, whether it's shares, whether it's bonds, whether it's whatever it is that you own as an asset, that where you've transferred your purchasing power, your money, to someone else to perform with it, or to, you know, do better with it and expect to get better, greater money later on. It's actually an asset that does nothing. But if you look at what's commonly called the price, the spot price, which is really an exchange rate. If you look at its exchange rate, I mean, it's been doing remarkably well. You know, I knew nothing about gold, Paul, for all my career as an actuary, because, you know, they don't teach you about gold at university or in the actuarial exams material or even in the CFA program. You know, I learned it because I had a lot of time in my hands after I left Mercer in 2004. And when I discovered this history, I bought so many books that were written in the 50s and 60s, and I thought, my God. And I started educating people for years. I went to conferences around the world talking to professionals about gold. But people don't care. They think about it, and they call it cognitive dissonance. It hurts, you know, to think that gold can be a good idea. They don't even want to have a conversation about it. But you're right. It is a form of insurance, in the sense that, you know, you will preserve your purchasing power. You just look at, I mean, it's not normal when something like gold, which does nothing, sits there, doesn't pay you any interest in the exchange rate for it, or its price, if you like, goes up on average over the last 24 years of this century so far by 9% per annum.
Yeah, wow. Well, that
9%
that
per annum over 24 years, by the way, is 8 times your money, you know?
Yeah, that tells you something, big time. All right, look, Louis, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way they can do that?
My website, lbnow.co.nz, or on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, but, you know, you'll have my phone number there on both platforms. And that's where. I mean, I don't call me to come and buy gold. I don't have any gold here. I mean, I use a firm out of Toronto, which is involved in both retail and wholesale, and I use it from a wholesale point of view for.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That firm is I've used since 2009, it's perfect solution for clients. Bullion Management Group is what their name is.
Okay, well, people can go there. Here's the last question, because where I'm living now, I see the remnants of old gold fields down here in the central Otago area where the rush was on back in the 1800s, late 1800s, and that every now and then, gold's taken out. It's more of sort of like a recreational thing now. But there are places in the country that have gold reserves. Should we be going crazy digging for gold right now, Louis, and getting as much in the vaults for the nation, not for private companies, but for the nation as possible, given that, you know, the clock keeps ticking? Would that be a sensible thing to do? I know it costs money to do it, but would that be sensible?
Well, it's what China's doing and has been doing for at least 10 years, if not more. They're the largest producer of mined gold in the world. Now, it's not the U.S. or South Africa, or Canada, as it used to be. But no, it's China, and not an ounce leaves the country. They've been adding. I mean, maybe we should. I mean, I think it would be a great idea, but it's a conversation that needs to be had with government or officials or people who can move the pendulum in terms of those circles, because I don't see it happening at the moment. But it's there. Maybe that's the plan, is keep it there until later. I don't know why New Zealand has no gold reserves. Canada is the same situation. I think we're just sadly passengers on a sinking ship of the West at the moment.
All right. Hey, Louis Boulanger, really fantastic to have you on our Money Talks. Really interesting to talk to you. You will be back. I know that.
Thank you. Loved it as well. Thanks, Paul.
And it won't be too long. We'll talk again soon, all right?
Okay. Cheers. Bye.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.